Thanks. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I thought, given my experience over the last 3 weeks of seeing other people give talks, I thought I would start with my take-home messages. So no matter where the conversation goes and how far I get through, there are two things that I would like to talk with people about and have you think about, and two things that I think about, for which I don't necessarily have answers. So the first thing is that by thinking about how things fall apart, we might be able to understand something evolutionarily about how they're put together. If we look at a cell and we see that some things in the cell fall apart with time and some things never fall apart with time, we might be able to infer from that something about the evolutionary forces that have shaped those things. And then the second message is that focusing on the building blocks of a cell and an organism, which is what I think of the metabolome as being, is a way to help us accomplish this. And so what I'm going to talk about today are some thoughts on these issues. I don't have answers to these things. I think they're big ongoing questions. I'm going to start with a very broad overview of the kinds of questions that people who work on the evolution of aging think about and the kind of ideas that have motivated the last 50 years of research. And then I'll talk about some specific pieces of research. So there are two really big questions that underlie the field. The first is really based on, it's more as much an ecological question as it is an evolutionary one, based on what we see in the world. And that is that if we look around us, we see that there are short-lived organisms like voles or mayflies that survive a day. Now, they have a many-month-long period in the larval stage in water, but when they come out as adults, they have one day to survive. And then what has been a real focus for a lot of people is trying to understand why some things live as long as they do. This is a favorite organism right now, definitely one of the most beautiful organisms on the planet. It's the naked mole rat, and I won't tell you what some people describe it as. This is a family friendly audience. So the cool thing about the naked mole rats, it's the size of a mouse, and it's eusocial, has a queen and workers, and lives underground in Africa. The queen suppresses reproduction in the workers, and the workers help raise the offspring. And they live in the lab for upwards of 30 years and cancer-free. Pretty amazing little organisms. Things that fly tend to live for a long time. Termites and ants and bees are really interesting. In eusocial species, the queens can live for a long time. There are ant queens where the queen can live for 30 years, even if the workers only live for a few months. Then there are long-lived large organisms like whales and sequoia trees, and some extremely long-lived small organisms. Steve Austed discovered that there are some clams off the coast, off the East Coast, that live for upwards of 500 years. This is the species that was found, and the longest-lived individual, they have rings like trees, and the longest-lived individual that they found was 500 years. And the way they found it was that they he was out on a boat, and the daughter of the guy who owned the boat was cleaning up these oysters and cleaned it out, tossed the clam overboard, and then handed Steve the shell, and he cut it and discovered it was 500 years old. So she had just thrown out the oldest living animal that we know. So that's sort of one big realm of questions. And then the other is not about variation among species, but variation within species. So we all experience aging around us. For those of us who are too young to have experienced it ourselves, I'm not among those. We see it in individuals among us. We see it in performance, so not just in what we look like, but so what we're looking at here is the speed, the world record speed as a function of age for marathons, and you can see from the age of about 40, there's a steady, continuous decline. Notable that there are people in their mid-90s who are still running or walking marathons, and notable that there are parents who allow their six-year-old kids to run marathons. And of course, steady difference between males and females as well. But of course, there's lots of variation too that's not explained. So these are speed records for just a single marathon, not world records. This was a ski marathon, 50 kilometers. And you can see there's a steady decline with age, but lots and lots of variation. Some of this is likely to due to environmental factors like training or what they had the night before or whether they grew up in Norway. And then others are likely due to genetics. We know there's a lot of genetic variation for the ability to breathe, for VO2 max, for example.
Daniel, that particular example doesn't show what most examples show. There's an increase in variance with age of so many different phenotypes. Would you agree that?
I think
variance increases as a function of age.
For some things, but not for all things.
I would say the majority.
This is actually a figure from a chapter some years ago that George wrote, which I think is an unasked question, both in sort of proximate mechanistic biology of aging as well as an evolutionary biology of aging, and that is why there are some things like nerve conduction velocity that don't seem to show strong signs of aging, and other things like VO2 max, for example, that do.
It's a question about nerve conduction velocity. That's of what you measure on a single neuron.
Presumably. And
is it not the case that, like, the number of active neurons goes down or anything like that?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, brains get smaller with age. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And those are cross-sectional studies. And Nathan Schock started towards the end of his career, longitudinal studies are very interesting. So a variance, for example, a glomerular filtration rate for renal function, that would generally go down. But there's some individuals, man, if they keep it up for a long period of time, and the variance is very substantial.
So when evolutionary biologists are studying aging, often they're focused on the age-related decline in fitness components, survival and reproduction. So these are just data from the United States mortality. And a couple things to note here. There's initially a high mortality rate, which then declines quite dramatically with age, and then it goes up. And around age 20, you start seeing, on a log scale, a linear increase. So mortality rates after about age 20 are increasing exponentially in human populations, both in developed countries and developing countries. They double every 8 years or so. So the rate of increase doesn't change a lot. You can see from 1933 to 2003, there's been a decline, and quite a dramatic decline, in mortality at all ages. Although the biggest declines have been in early life. So this is mostly due to improvements in hygiene, that people are not dying, kids are not dying of infectious disease now the way they did 100 years ago. And there's even increasing survival very late in life, but the benefit is smaller. So the big evolutionary question that goes back well over a century is, why is it that we see these increases in mortality or age-related declines in fitness components? If selection is such a powerful force, why doesn't it get rid of them? Yeah?
Is there such a kinkiness in these curves?
Right here?
Yeah.
So at least in males, this is testosterone poisoning. This is teenagers doing stupid stuff like jumping off bridges. People. High risk. This is about high risk behavior. Yeah, and if you look at the causes of mortality here, it's high risk behavior. It's suicide, drugs, and car accidents.
And is there a real difference between 1993 and 2003 for females in terms of the access to high risk behavior, or is that just my imagination? It looks like there's more of a kink in the 2003 data.
I think it's that. We've reduced this mortality more than we've reduced this mortality. Yeah.
On the other hand, those motorcycle riders that get knocked off, they contribute to the fitness of recipients of renal transplants and so on.
So this big question is, you know, why doesn't selection get rid of it? And of course, we have some good answers now. And people usually start with Haldane, but I've actually, I think we really need to start with Julia Bell. So Julia Bell lived for a century. She was a centenarian when she died. And she was the primary author on a set of volumes, The Treasury of Human Inheritance. And she worked out the genetic basis of a lot of human diseases in the early 20th century. She figured out linkage using maximum likelihood. She figured out sex linkage, really all kinds of things. And one of the things that she was studying was Huntington disease. And this is where, and her co-authors on these books included Pearson and Fisher and a guy named Lionel Penrose. And she's sort of an unsung hero. I don't think she gets the credit that she deserves. But so starting fairly early on, she was working with Haldane and modeling the genetics of these diseases. And this got Haldane thinking about Huntington disease. So Bell had been working on Huntington disease in England. And just a little bit of a segue. So what she found was that the frequency of Huntington disease was about 1 in 18,000, which is about something like 5.610 minus 4. And Haldane was working with her and trying to figure out how to understand that. So if you think about the expected frequency for a dominant mutation under mutation selection balance is the mutation frequency divided by the selection coefficient. So Huntington disease is caused by a dominant mutation. We now know the molecular biology. They didn't. They didn't know about DNA. And so if your parent has Huntington disease, you have a 50-50 chance of getting it. And the interesting thing about Huntington disease is that the earliest age onset is in people's 20s, but generally in the population, most people exhibit it in their 40s and 50s. So Haldane knew all about this. He developed part of mutation selection balance theory. And he was trying to understand, why is it so frequent if we think of mutations at a gene of, let's say, 10 to the minus 6, and selection on Huntington, it's lethal, so let's say S is 1. So the frequency should be 10 to the minus 6. And what Haldane recognized, his insight, which today seems obvious, but at the time people weren't thinking about this, is that if you have a disease but it's not expressed until you're 50, by that time, certainly in the 1910s and 20s, you will have already had kids, your kids will have already had kids, and so you will have passed that on to your offspring long before you even know that you're going to get it. So selection is not one, because these people are having kids and grandkids, and so Haldane recognized that if selection is much less than one, there's not that much selection against the disease, then you could actually have a much higher frequency. And this led Haldane to appreciate that we don't need to actually explain why Huntington disease is so common. It's just a question of mutation selection balance. And so I just want to give a little bit of a segue. So Mike was talking about the whole point of this workshop as developing collaborations. And so one of the things that Joanna and George and Kuhn and I were talking about coming down here was trying to understand something about frequency of diseases and variation. And in the course of our conversation, we started thinking about other traits that might not be so easy to explain. And one of them that we thought about was pediatric cancer. So I think a lot about this. My wife is a pediatric hematologist-oncologist who works on leukemia, bone marrow transplants. So if you think about acute lymphocytic leukemia, ALL, frequency of ALL is about 10 to the minus 3. And so it doesn't make sense that it's as common as it is. Even if you think that there are quite a number of genes that could lead to ALL, it still doesn't make sense, especially when you consider that you need mutations of more than one gene to end up with ALL. And in trying to, so we've been working on models to explain why ALL is as common as it is. And this led me to think about, more generally, the challenge of understanding why different traits are rare or common. And I'll come back to that in a minute. Yeah.
Maybe not totally relevant question, but I think it's maybe interesting. So this mutation selection balance theory, it's not quite relevant to the human population, right? I mean, like, first of all, the human population has been expanding over the past, whatever, 200, 300 years, right, mm-hmm. exponentially. Mm-hmm. So has the, and we know that in an exponentially growing population, selection against deleterious mutations is actually relaxed, right? So deleterious mutations have sort of bigger, higher chance to spread. So have people looked at the frequency, at the change of the frequency of these kind of diseases? Do they change or do they not change?
It's hard to know. So there are data, for example, on frequency of these diseases in pre-industrial populations. And the challenge is that often, so if you look at, even in a large population, but in a developing country, if you look at the statistics, frequency of things like ALL is very low and sometimes zero. The problem is there's an ascertainment bias. So in Cambodia, if a kid gets ALL, it looks like he has an infection that doesn't go away and then he dies. And so it's a good question, but it's really hard to know.
With respect to atherosclerosis, which is the disease that's going to kill most of us, Tuck Finch, Caleb Finch from the University of Southern California, his colleagues have been looking at Egyptian mummies and mummies, ancient mummies from other cultures, and he finds a hell of a lot of atherosclerosis. Same, and also in the typical places, in the, particularly the abdominal aorta and in the coronary artery. So that's an example of a major cause of mortality that apparently goes way, way back. And we always thought it was, you know, it was diet, high fat, so on, but something more related to the biology of aging.
So to answer your question in terms of theory perspective, you know, a lot of that, theory you're referring to really sort of posits the main tension as being between selection and drift. And this is theory that posits the main tension being between selection and mutation bias. And so the interesting theory about thing about that is if it's true that mutation is a bigger restriction on the force of selection than drift is, then luckily one of those problems, those theoretical problems you're thinking of, completely go away. And that's the conclusion that I'm coming to, just partly just based on the data. I mean, there just is an awful lot of explanatory power in the mutation rate theory, whereas we don't have a proper, you know, our drift barrier theory is quite primitive and at this point has little explanatory power with respect to these kinds of things, and mutation rate clearly has explanatory power.
So you're saying that the fact that the population is expanding is actually not playing a big role here?
I mean, I haven't done all of the theory for it, but my intuition as a population geneticist tells me that it's going to be less important.
There's data from human, like there was a fairly recent paper, I think, by Andy Clark, where they show this excess of, I think, deleterious polymorphisms in the human population. And I think they explain it by expansion, like super expansion.
Oh yeah, so when you look at the number of, yeah, I mean.
I was just wondering about the data. I mean, I think what you're saying makes sense, right, that the mutation.
The mutation is a big pull. Well, it depends, they're looking at sort of the same polymorphisms over time, and we're sort of looking at across conditions. which have different mutation rates or different structure, you know.
That's interesting.
And so the explanatory power might be different when you, because in his case, he's controlling for mutation rate variation because they're all subject to identical mutation rate, and then you can see drift effects. But when that's not true, the variation in mu might be greater than the variation in drift.
But then for somatic versus germline mutations, the model is going to be completely different. Though.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're talking about germline mutations here.
ALL
model. Oh, sorry, with the ALL model. I don't want to go into the details, but the basic ideas were
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, so what we're talking about there is a sort of trade-off model that there's a benefit in generating antibody diversity, and a lot of leukemias are caused by translocations that appear to be associated with VDJ recombination. And so there's a trade-off there where you've got selection to generate diversity at the cost of generating cancer. And so that's the argument for why, whether it's true or not, we don't know, but that what we're modeling is that the mutation selection balance argument fails because something else is going on. There's a trade-off.
Just a quick, straightforward question. Should there be a square root?
So this is for a dominant mutation like Huntington. For a recessive mutation, then you'll get square root of mu over s. Yeah.
So now I have a disconnect. So are you going to talk more about the model? Are you going to say anything more about what Joanna just said? Because now I'm lost. I thought this is like an inherited disease, and now you're talking about
Let me come back to that in 2 slides.
Okay. And then just one other thing. And is there some influence? Just like, so now we have all kinds of therapies and medicines. So people with diseases that might have killed them, maybe not this one, but diseases that might kill them, now they stay alive, now they reproduce. That must be part of.
This is what your colleague argues. That in doing that, in relaxing selection, we're actually accumulating more mutations in the human population. Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
So there's a, in your, what was that, 2010?
Yeah, I feel.
Or 2011, when was that paper?
Pretty strongly that's going on, but I'm not sure that there's been enough time for something like this. I don't know that. Across the whole genome, but I think there's pronounced change, but I think at a single locus like this, I doubt it changes the
map too much. Yeah, I would agree with you.
The way that you said that, does that mean that you disagree with
esteemed
colleague here?
No, I agree completely. I'm agnostic about the degree to which the genome is, the mutation load in the genome is accumulating because of medical care or whatever. I don't have a strong opinion. I haven't looked at the data, but certainly at a single locus, you know, there hasn't been enough time to make a difference.
So as an aside, all of the developed societies have been seeing a postponement of the age of reproduction with a shortage of mating males and females, so they anticipate a spike in the number of mutations. And I tell my colleagues in neurology that in the future we're going to see new neurological diseases.
Right. But that future might be 100,000 years away.
Well, that's right, but that's really a long time.
Okay, so I want to move on to actually the aging theory that came out of Haldane and Bell's ideas about Huntington. And so Medawar.
Just one more question. About
sure.
I might be wrong in this, but. I thought that like this big population of Nancy Drexler studies.
Venezuela?
I thought that was trinucleotide repeat stuff.
It is. It's a polyglutamine disease. That's right. So, and the longer the number of.
So that actually gives you a very high, higher than normal mutation rate at the locus. It's not
likely.
The standard base up rate. So that sort of.
That
makes this argument go away a bit. I mean, I agree with the denominator thing, but it's got a high, probably higher than normal.
Yeah, probably. And I'll come back to that in a second. So Peter Medawar went on to win a Nobel Prize for his work on tissue transplantation. But he had read Haldane, and he thought, you know, if this is true of a dominant lethal mutation, is it not true of a mutation that has extremely small effects but also acts late in life? So he wrote, if a genetic disaster happens late enough, it doesn't matter. But in fact, he wasn't just thinking about genetic disasters. He was thinking about tiny little errors of low cost as well. And so if this is mortality in the schematic, and you have mutations that arise at young age and mutations that arise at old age, he assumes that there are young acting mutations and old acting mutations. Selection then comes along, and it weeds out the young acting mutations, but not the old acting mutations. And so over evolutionary time, you have this accumulation of germline mutations with late acting effects to a much greater extent than those with early acting effects, which selection has gotten rid of. So basically, every organism is a bag of ticking time bombs waiting to go off. The ones with short fuses are eliminated by selection. The ones with long fuses aren't. And the longer the fuse, the less likely it is to be eliminated. And Hamilton then, Bill Hamilton came along in 1966 and actually modeled this process. And I won't go through the actual theory. It's based on the Euler-Lotka equation. It's fairly straightforward. And what he's showing here, and this is actually a redrawn example from Kim Hughes. Bill's figures aren't very good. What his theory shows is that think about this as the intensity of selection on a mutation that either decreases fertility a little bit, shown in gray, or decreases survival a little bit, shown in black. And if we just focus on the black curve, what the theory tells us is that a mutation that has an effect on survival early in life is, under strong selection, to be eliminated until reproduction starts, and then it's steadily and fairly, the intensity of selection against that mutation steadily and fairly rapidly declines. So if we think about this as our little s, so little s is and I think this is something that hasn't been really addressed in the literature, except just in terms of aging, that this little s is actually a function of age x. And if we think, for example, about what's our null model? So in another collaboration that's come out of this workshop is that Joanna and I are actually writing a little paper for non-evolutionary biologists to ask themselves, if they have an evolutionary idea, what do they need to do? And one of the first things they need to do is ask, well, what's the null model? And the null model in this case, actually, for Huntington, for example, that's the frequency. Could we explain it in terms of the mutation rate at a polyglutamine repeat? And in terms of selection, selection is not one here. It's a lot less than one. And in fact, in a human population, we could figure out exactly what the selection is integrated over the lifetime, weighted by the percentage of individuals that survived each age. So more generally, if we think about these kind of models for a dominant or for a recessive gene, and recognize that selection is weighted, what this does is it creates a framework for us to think about when we're looking at disease. So there's a big field now of evolutionary medicine. There are evolutionary medicine journals. But what no one is asking is, what diseases can be explained away in terms of this null model and don't need any adaptive explanation? The journals are full of adaptive explanations for everything. And so one of the insights for me, anyway, that's come out of this workshop is recognizing that by combining this simple framework and this simple framework, we have an idea, we have a way of figuring out what do we need evolutionary explanations for in terms of human disease, and what doesn't need at least adaptive explanations. So that was my little segue, and I want to come back to aging. So there are actually two evolutionary theories. So the simplest one is Medawar's, and then George Williams came along a few years later in 1957 and suggested that selection could actually favor these deleterious mutations that increase mortality if they have beneficial effects early in life. So he calls this antagonistic pleiotropy. Pleiotropy because he's assuming that one mutation has both an early age effect and a late age effect, so it's pleiotropic, but in opposite directions, so it's antagonistic. So that's sort of the basic theoretical framework for why we age. And so what I want to talk to you about today in terms of experiments and results is first some data that don't come from my lab. I'm going to talk about work from other labs because I think it's really relevant to this workshop, and so I thought you might want to hear about it. And then as much time as I have, I'll talk through some of these things. So this is work on using metabolomics as a way of understanding the genetic basis of a complex phenotype, aging. So if we go back to Williams in his paper in Evolution, I actually think this was the first volume of Evolution, said the theory regards senescence as an evolved characteristic of the soma. So Williams assumes that there's a distinction between the germline, the immortal germline, and the non-immortal somatic tissue. So going back to Weismann, he says, we should find it wherever a soma has been evolved, but not elsewhere. So where we don't see a germline soma distinction, we shouldn't see aging. So let's ask if that's true. So this is aquatic oligotrophic bacterium, Colobacter crescentis. And it doesn't have a separate germline and soma, but like a budding yeast, we can distinguish mother cell and daughter cell. So the mother cell attaches itself to the substrate with a stalk and then releases daughter cells, which swim off and then can attach themselves. And the nice thing about this is that if you have on a petri dish or on a glass cover slip, if you have these bacteria and you have enough undergraduates, you can watch this happening in real time and you can count the number of swarmers that are released and the rate at which they're released. And when you do that, you see something like this. So the age-specific reproductive output as a function of hours goes steadily down. So tracking these individuals, their reproductive output actually decreases with age. So that's one example. And then a second example comes from E. coli. So with E. coli, we don't have a mother cell and a daughter cell, but there still is a kind of asymmetry. So this is work from the Tadei lab in Paris. So if you think about division of E. coli, so here's a cell that's about to divide, and if the division is happening in the middle, we can think of that as the new part of the cell, and the outside as the old part of the cell. So the cell divides, and these are the number of divisions that that part of the cell has experienced. So after one division, this pole that had already had one division now has two, this one now has one, but these are new, so they have zero, and so on and so forth. And you can ask, as these cells accumulate a longer history of division, does that affect their growth rate? And yeah.
I don't understand why those two cells in the two ends of the first cell are different from each other.
So this assumes that this already came from a hypothetical bacteria that was zero and zero. I mean, it could be zero and zero, and then this would go to one and one. So it's just a schematic. So the idea is that every time you divide, the outside of the cell ratchets up one. That's the real point of the trigger.
Zero, it's one side.
Yeah, you can't.
That's the youngest cell you've ever imagined.
I understand that.
Except the
why is the
first cell
thing called zero and the right thing called
It's arbitrary.
Okay. And then, can you just define what you mean by senescence?
So in this case, senescence. So what Eric Stewart did is he actually took videos of of these cells dividing in two dimensions, and he tracked individual cells, and he measured the division time. How long did it take a cell to go through a cycle and divide?
Division time, or how many times they can...
For each cell, how long did it take for that cell to divide?
That's the definition of senescence.
So in this case...
The rate of senescence.
The division rate. And in this case, this is not a really great figure, but what it illustrates, so in this case, red is the old pole and blue is the new pole. Blue is always, for any division, the new pole is the cell that inherits the new pole is shown on the left. And what you can see is that the blue is always a little bit longer than I think this is actually division rate. So that, anyway, what this is meant to illustrate is that the cells that are older in the sense of having gone through more divisions divide less.
We can talk about it. I think it's not exactly semantics. It's either how many times they can divide or how long it takes them to divide. Their lifetime, they can only...
Right, and in this case, because... So they are looking at time because to actually follow a cell long enough to the point where it stops dividing, they wouldn't be able to tell all the cells apart because there would be millions of cells. So they're actually looking at the time. And the older cells divide. The quote-unquote older cells divide slower. And there's actually some theory to explain why this might evolve. So you might ask, well, why instead of this kind of asymmetric division, why not just repair what you've got? Or why have a young pole and an old pole? Why not just have everything effectively symmetrical? And two different groups, David Steinsaltz at Oxford and Martin Ackerman, both modeled this. And I'll show you Martin's theory. They both come to the same conclusions, but Martin's a little more intuitive. So imagine that you start with a cell that has some amount of damage, D, and that in the time that it takes for the cell to get ready to divide, it accumulates some new amount of damage, K, and then it splits that damage between two cells. And the amount in each cell is 1 plus A over 2 and 1 minus A over 2. So if A is 0, this cell gets a half of the damage, and that cell gets a half of the damage. It's completely symmetrical. And then there's also some survival, which is a function of damage. So survival is lower in this guy because it has more damage than in this guy. So that's the gist of the model.
Is it protein?
Could be anything. Anything at all.
Or right?
And we actually, and as I'll show you, we actually know a lot about that in yeast. So, and then there's one little addition, complication, they say, well, there's also the possibility to repair that damage. So your survival is a function of the damage, but you can ameliorate the reduction in survival by repairing some of that damage. And when they model this, as they do it analytically as well as with simulations, and so here's a simulation where you start out with no asymmetry, so A is 0 here, equal division, but you have repair. And here's the investment in repair, and it goes up to some equilibrium value. And then, after 50,000 cycles, they allow asymmetry to evolve. And what you see is that asymmetry very quickly evolves, and as it evolves, investment in repair actually goes to 0. So if you can have asymmetric division in this model, it actually trumps having repair. The benefit of being able to sequester damage such that you produce cells that are effectively healthier than you are is enough to not even need repair. Of course, if we think about the real world, so this is from a recent review on how yeast cells manage to sequester damage into the mother cell. So this is a schematic of Saccharomyces with the mother cell and the budding daughter cell. And there are actually a lot of things going on, but one of the really interesting things is that you have this retrograde flow along the actin filaments. And there are a couple of things that appear to be happening. One is that people doing this work anyway are arguing that this retrograde flow creates a selection gradient for mitochondria, and that the mitochondria, basically only the fittest or best mitochondria, are able to get into the daughter cell against this retrograde flow. The retrograde flow has also been argued by some to actually clear out protein aggregation, although there's also a sort of neutral model or null model where there's just a lot of noisy flow in these cells, and if this space right here is small enough, the aggregated proteins can't get through and they end up staying in the mother cell and not the daughter cell. So there are actually mechanisms that people are thinking about to understand how it might be that this asymmetric division of errors, garbage, can be set up. So the biology of aging is really a field where there are two very different kinds of ways of thinking about it. There are people doing evolutionary biology and people are doing molecular biology, and they rarely come together, and when they do come together, it's often not so much coming together as people who are doing molecular biology making evolutionary arguments without the benefit of knowing kind of the mechanisms of how evolution works. There's a rich body of literature on the molecular biology, and it's really focused on things that happen in the cell. So when people talk about mechanical or mechanistic theories of aging, exhausting stem cells, cellular senescence, mitochondrial dysfunction, loss of proteostasis, telomere attrition, genomic instability, they're all things that are happening in cells of every metazoan organism where people look. And then at a genetic level, there appear to be some evolutionarily conserved pathways. So in this schematic, it shows two pathways in particular, the target of rapamycin or TOR pathway and the insulin, IGF-1 insulin signaling pathway. And these pathways seem to be associated with aging. When you knock out genes in these pathways, you increase longevity in worms, flies, mammals, in yeast, at least for TOR. It's not clear that this is exactly homologous with the insulin signaling pathway. So there are these evolutionarily conserved pathways, at least according to lab studies. So what can we conclude from the data so far? We know that aging has a genetic basis, and in fact, data going back to the 1930s from Pearl and the 1950s from John Maynard Smith show in insects that aging has a genetic basis. It appears from the lab that longevity is influenced by genes with major effects. I think this is actually problematic, as I'll suggest. It appears that these pathways are evolutionarily conserved. I'm not going to go into detail about why I think this might not be true, other than to say that all of these studies come from organisms that are well adapted to the lab. And my concern is that in adapting to the lab, we've changed the TOR pathway, which is a growth pathway and a nutrient sensing pathway, and the insulin signaling pathway, which very simply put is a way of, we've modulated it in such a way that we're selecting for organisms that can quickly turn nutrients into offspring. And so when we shut those down, it may not be surprising that they live longer. So the challenge is how do we translate these findings to the real world? So here's just data from my own lab showing that mortality curves in fruit flies look kind of like mortality curves in humans. If you squint the right way, they go on a log scale, they go down initially, and then they go up pretty much linearly with age. And these are all different genotypes. There's tons of genetic variation. So
I don't understand why, I mean, for human, the human behavior would explain the dip at around 20 or something. But for Drosophila, what happened?
So we don't know why flies die, but one possibility is that initially these are sort of the not so good flies that very quickly get weeded out. It's a demographic selection that's happening in the population. But we see it in everywhere we look. And there is some theory about why that might be the case, certainly in human to explain in human populations where you have complex social behavior in things like flies and worms. It's a good question.
This is after hatching, is it? Or is this a kid with pupa at that stage?
This is after eclosion from the pupa. So this is adults, yeah.
So what you say is variable, heritable, that information is not in this graph.
Oh, so these are all different genotypes, and they're repeatable, and the genetics explains, in terms of mean lifespan, genetics explains 30% plus in flies of the variation. So it's a very large genetic component to longevity in flies and everywhere we look. And we also know it's polygenic based on selection, artificial selection experiments and crosses, and it doesn't segregate as a Mendelian trait lifespan. So in humans, well, we can, in human populations, we can do genome-wide association studies with SNP maps. And here's the big problem. When we do that, so this is looking at the distribution of effect size for single nucleotide polymorphism on height, on Crohn's disease, and on three different kinds of cancer. And this is typical of just about any complex trait that we look at in humans. So notice that the scale here goes from 0.1 to 1% of total genetic variance explained by a SNP. And so typically, the most common polymorphisms are explaining somewhere between a 0.1% or 1/1000th of the variation and 0.5% or 0.02% of the variation in the population. And so there's a big kind of, we talk about the missing heritability problem. We try and get at the genes. When we do GWAS on human longevity, many studies have been done. For example, comparing centenarians and non-centenarians. And there's one locus that always shows up that's highly significantly associated with lifespan, and that's the APOE locus. And there's nothing else that shows up in most studies. But we know that lifespan in humans is not a Mendelian trait caused by variation at APOE. So this, to me, is the big problem. And one of the things that people have discovered fairly recently is that if you do GWAS on the metabolome, you get some different results. So this figure comes from a paper on a GWAS study of cholesterol levels. And what you're looking at here, each...
What is GWAS?
A genome-wide association study. So basically, you measure anywhere between thousands and millions of polymorphisms spread throughout the genome. And at each polymorphism, you ask, are you associated with the trait? And so if you do that for cholesterol level, you get the figure that I showed you. If you do it for the metabolites that are thought to contribute to cholesterol level, here's what you get. So each one of these bars represents either a single metabolite or the ratio of two metabolites. The blue is heritability, so the proportion of variation explained by genetics. And red is the proportion of variation explained by a single nucleotide polymorphism. So if we expand this a little bit so we can see it better. So here, for example, is a single nucleotide polymorphism explaining about 25% of the variation in the ratio of these two metabolites, linoleic acid to a polyunsaturated fatty acid. There's another example. So effect size per allele copy, this is another GWAS study where they found a SNP that 60% of a metabolite was explained by variation at the acyl-CoA dehydrogenase locus involved in fatty acid metabolism. So here's the problem. We're trying to get from genotype to phenotype to understand the genetic basis of complex traits, ultimately of fitness traits like survival and reproduction. And the distance between genotype and phenotype, I think, it's astronomical in its complexity, that between genotype and phenotype, it's not a simple one-to-one mapping. It's not that an enzyme or protein produced by a gene like the apolipoprotein E locus somehow causes someone to die or live. But of course, in between these things, we've got the transcriptome and the proteome and the metabolome, the microbiome, the epigenome, which I haven't drawn. We have networks of interacting molecules within each level and between each level. We have arrows going in both directions. We have the environment. And so what we're trying to do in GWAS studies is go right from genotype to phenotype, and there's this enormous complex black box in the middle that I think is preventing us from doing it successfully. And so what I'm arguing is that if we break down these complex networks into their component parts, we might be able to tease them apart. So for example, we heard about epistasis yesterday. If rather than just going from genotype to phenotype and maybe being able to identify epistatic interactions between genes that affect the phenotype, maybe the really important epistatic interactions are happening at the level of these individual interacting molecules. And so by going from genotype to these individual components and their network structure, and then ultimately to phenotype, we can build a much more comprehensive understanding of how genotype shapes phenotype. So that's what we're trying to do in my lab, and that I'll just mention that we're also interested in thinking about. So in the last few minutes, I'll talk a little bit about diet restriction. So we've known for almost a century that lifespan is a function of food concentration. Here's a food concentration that keeps flies happy, with a pretty high growth rate, and this is females and males, and this has been shown many times in flies and many other species. If you reduce the concentration, you increase the lifespan to a point, and then you move the fly into starvation mode.
So in this
particular study, it's concentration of just diluting the food. In fact, if you reduce the concentration of yeast, you get the strongest effect. So reduce protein concentration, you increase lifespan. There's some studies that have shown that if you reduce the concentration of methionine, you get an increase in lifespan, although this guy here has argued that that's because, at least in Drosophila, the natural food has toxic levels of methionine for a fly, and so if you reduce it, you're just giving them better food.
But concentration is bothering the fly. Couldn't they just eat more?
They don't.
Oh, okay.
They could, but the people have looked at feeding rates in all kinds of ways, and you can alter feeding rates by altering food concentrations, but they don't ingest more food. They reproduce less and live longer. So we've done an experiment. I've been collaborating with a couple of folks at the Buck Institute in California, where we've raised flies on high yeast and low yeast diets, and then measured the metabolome. So what we're looking at here are principal component analysis. Each one of these points represents a fly sample, and we're in metabolome space here. And you can see three different tissues that are clearly separable. And also in each case, you can see that diet restriction separates the high concentration from the low concentration population quite clearly. So one of the questions we were interested in is whether the reason that flies live longer under diet restriction is that we're actually slowing the rate of change in the metabolome.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that the heart lasts longer or it decays slower? What does it mean that it moved?
So what that means is simply that the distribution of metabolites in this high-dimensional metabolite space is changed, and it changed in the same way for all the tissues under diet restriction. And this is a little bit more specific, metabolite by metabolite. So what I'm showing you here when I put these metabolites on will be the effect of age. So metabolites on this side are, the metabolites over here are going up with age, but if they're below this line, they're going down with diet restriction. And on the other quadrant up here, metabolites on this side are going down with age, but up with diet restriction. So if a metabolite is in this quadrant here, that means that when it goes down with age, it actually looks younger. And if it's in this quadrant here, when it goes up with age, it actually looks younger. And if it's in this quadrant or this quadrant, then diet restriction would make the metabolite look older. And when we put all the metabolites in there, this is the pattern that we see. There are thousands of metabolites right in the middle that are not significant, and they're little black specks. The blue ones are significant for age only, the green ones for diet only, and then the red ones are significant for both. So if we just look at metabolites that are significantly affected by age and diet, we can actually do a little bit sort of the metabolome equivalent of gene set enrichment analysis. And we see that, not surprisingly, there's a, because we're changing proteins here, there's a big effect of amino acids. Interestingly, in metabolome studies in aging, we see what looks to be an enrichment for metabolites that are associated with kynurenine, which is a tryptophan breakdown, and also associated with neurotransmitters. So we're really interested in that.
Is there a disproportionate amount of methionine playing a role there?
We haven't looked, I didn't look particularly at methionine relative to these other amino acids, so I don't know. But the other thing that we can do is actually look at network structure. And so in these kind of big data omic studies, what the first thing that people do is they'll do some manipulation, and then they'll look at transcripts or protein abundance or metabolite abundance and ask, is there a change? So for example, here we're looking at two undefined metabolites. We just know their mass charge ratio. And this is the high yeast and this is the low yeast. There's no effect. This is the high yeast and this is low yeast. There's no effect. So typically we'd say, all right, well, these two metabolites aren't affected by diet. We can go home. But if you look at how they're related to each other, so here are these two metabolites. And under high yeast conditions, they're negatively correlated. And under low yeast conditions, they're positively correlated. And we find this not just for individual pairs, but for large groups of metabolites. So this heat map shows about 1,000 by 1,000 metabolites order in the same order. And so this block here is a block of metabolites that are all positively correlated with each other under the high yeast condition. And if we keep the same order, these are the same metabolites, and in this case also positively correlated under diet restriction. And we can divide them into modules using a hierarchical clustering approach. And you can see, for example, that here's a module made up of metabolites that are not correlated under ad lib, but are under diet restriction. And when we do this, we find examples of metabolites that are not correlated under ad lib and are under diet restriction, or metabolites that are correlated under ad lib and are not under diet restriction, as well as groups of metabolites that don't change a whole lot between them. And we can do enrichment for these modules to try and figure out what they are. And the long-term goal of doing this is partly actually to get back to this question of asking, are there physiological traits, but are there modules that change in response to age or other phenotypes and others that don't? And can we back up and ask what they are and understand, for example, differences in terms of the way that selection has shaped one module versus another module that might influence whether it falls apart with age or not?
To what extent do males and females differ in the network structures you were just showing? Are there any sex differences?
So we just looked at males here, but we do know that there are dramatic differences in network structure between males and females. So we haven't done all the network analysis for the data that we collected for that aging cell paper, but I'm hoping to have someone in my lab go back and actually do network analysis on all of that, including trying to understand what. So we know there's a huge effect of age on the metabolome, sorry, of sex on the metabolome. So if you,
and their age get mad at you unless you include both sexes.
So this is for all the metabolites log transformed. This is just the intensity of females and the intensity of males. The red dots are not significantly different. All the blue dots are metabolites that are either higher in males or higher in females. And if you do principal component analysis in this across species, it was actually the first axis. In this study, it wasn't the first axis, but you can see they almost perfectly separate by sex. So there's a huge effect of sex on the metabolome. Not surprising here because these were whole body, so we're including eggs and sperm and all that kind of stuff. We have samples in the freezer that we haven't run yet of fly heads, and we're really interested in the difference between a male head and a female head. And we've also got data on mated females and unmated females, so we can actually look at how mating changes the head metabolome in a fly.
So the prostate gland and dichotomization story, is that related to the lifespan differences? The prostate gland
we can't ask because it's only present in half the species.
Is it too small?
Yeah, I mean, the melanogaster group is relatively short-lived, but we just have, we have 2 points, one short-lived group, one long-lived group, so we can't do statistics.
Yeah, I think that's related to the oxidative damage story. I think Thomas Montine is interested in that. You talked to him, our chairman.
I think we're
all,
So that in terms of the wrap up, so I want to sort of just back up to the original points that I made, and I'm really interested in trying to find a way. I mean, the title is about bridging genotype and phenotype. I'm interested in ways to use aging as a way to bridge molecular approaches and evolutionary approaches. And until now, the evolutionary approaches have been agnostic about mechanism. Although one of the things that we're here working on is writing a grant that will try and use evolutionary principles to understand something about mechanisms. And ultimately, I'm really interested in trying to understand something about how evolution put things together by understanding the different ways in which they fell apart. And but I think, you know, we're in high-dimensional space here, and my way of teasing apart that high-dimensional space is to use the metabolome, which we can actually measure a big chunk of that space. And I just want to finish up by saying it takes a lot of people to do this work, and I want to thank folks in my lab, graduate students and postdocs, and lots of undergrads and collaborators at the University of Washington and elsewhere, and thank you for your attention. And for also for providing an incredibly stimulating, inspiring environment.
Okay, well, before we all go off and bear fruit, I'd like to thank everybody for their participation and the other people who are here today. Especially, we'd like to thank Rob and who ran the course and did just this amazing job with the course. And there's no way this would have happened without Rob. And then Shelley did most of the other organizing, really. So there were some people at KITP behind the scenes, of course, but at least you guys.